All right. Good evening, everyone. Let's begin. So, what I'd like to try to do over the next, I think probably a little bit before Yom Tov and Emirat Hashem over the course of Shavuos as well, is to focus a little bit on Megillas Rus. Megillas Rus is a multifaceted story and an incredibly dynamic story with so many different layers and so many different messages. And so hopefully over the course of the next couple of Shiurim, we'll have the opportunity to explore a couple of different aspects of this incredibly dynamic Megillah. Okay, I'm going to operate under the assumption that everyone knows the basic story of Megillas Rus. So tonight, actually, what I'd like to do is not focus on the story at all. Instead, what I'd like to try to do is focus a bit more globally on the Megillah as a whole. And you'll see my point of departure. Take a look at number one. So the Medrash Yalkut Shimoni writes as follows. I'm Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Zeira said, Megillas Rus, ein ba lo tuma velo tara. He says, now without getting into the technicalities here, but there's an interesting halacha which says that when you have scrolls, right, for example, so to this very day, we are very careful. We don't touch a Torah scroll directly by hand. If we have to move it, we'll use a talis or use something else. So that's for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons for that is because it shows a certain level of sanctity, a certain level of respect, ultimately, for the scroll. But in addition to that, there was a concept, and again, I don't want to get too much into the weeds over here, but there's a concept of that kisve kodesh, holy writings, convey ritual impurity to hands, which I know sounds like a dramatically backwards idea. That if I go ahead and I touch a Sefer Torah, my hands become ritually impure. So you ask yourself, why would the rabbis legislate such a halacha like that? So it's actually a fascinating reason. The Gemara points out that it used to be that they used to store truma. Truma, remember, again, is the portion of the grain that you would give to the Kohen. They used to store truma in the Aron Kodesh, in the Ark by the Torah scrolls. Why? What was the logic? They would say, well, the Torah is holy, the Truma is holy, put that which is holy next to that which is holy. Beautiful, beautiful idea. Beautiful idea, except one problem, which is that the mice got into the Aron Kodesh, began to go ahead and eat the Truma, and once they were there, they nibbled at the scrolls as well. So in an effort to ensure that people would not store Truma in the Aron Kodesh, they said, if you touch a Torah scroll, your hands become ritually impure. If your hands become ritually impure, then if you end up touching Truma, you actually can invalidate Truma. Okay, so that's a long... So therefore, again, all of our Kisvei Kodesh, all of our holy writings have this halacha. They are metamenes hayadayim. If you touch them, they convey ritual impurity to your hands. So the Medrash makes an amazing observation. Megillas Rus, right? Megillas Rus, ein bo lo tuma velo tara. It does not convey this type of tumah. So for example, if you touch Megillas Esther, so your hands become ritually impure. Koheles is an interesting machlokis by itself because there's a whole discussion about Koheles. Hey, but if you touch Megillas Esther, touch a Sefer Torah. But if you touch Megillas Rus, it does not convey tumah to your hands. And if I were to ask you, what does that tell you? If it doesn't convey tumah to your hands, what does that tell you? Sounds like it's not Sefer Kodesh. Sounds like it's not, obviously, at least on the basic level, it's not on the same level as Megillas Esther. Furthermore, says the Medrash, lo heter velo iser. Interestingly enough, there are no halachas contained in Megillas Rus. Now, the truth is that this statement by itself is subject to dispute because, in fact, as we know, many of the halachos, many of the laws that we have as regarding conversion are actually gleaned from Megillas Rus. Now, albeit a bit indirectly, but nevertheless, there's no overt lesson of halacha. Meaning, if you look at Megillas Rus really is what? It's a story. It's a story. So this leading the Medrash to understand, I don't understand, what's the nature of this book, of this Megillah? On one hand, it doesn't convey ritual impurity, which shows that it's different than a regular scroll. It doesn't have halachos, lo hefter v'lo iser, v'la menichtava. So why do we have it? Such an interesting idea. So the Medrash asks, why do I have Megillah? So let's listen to this. Second line, number one. Kedei lelamdecha scharam shalgom lechasadim. There is one simple message, says the Medrash from Megillas Rus, to teach you the incredible reward for those who do chesed. Megillas Rus is all about the power of chesed. All about the power of kindness. Which chesed is the Medrash referring to? So this is not initially clear. If on the most basic level, we would assume it's the chesed of who? Of Rus. That's the assumption, the Chesed of Rus. In fact, the Chesed of Rus is alluded to multiple times. If you take a look at number two, Vayan Boaz Vayomer La, who gave to Godly, Kol Asher Asis Es Chamoseich Acharei Mos Isheich Vataazvi Avich VeImech VeEres Molarateich VeTelchi El Am Asher Lo Yadat Tmo Shel Shom. So this pasuk is actually gleaned from the first interaction between Boaz and Rus. Rus comes onto Boaz's field. Boaz asks, who is this girl? He's introduced to Rus, and he says, oh, I've heard of you. I've heard of you. Why have I heard about you? Because I have heard of the incredible things that you did for your mother-in-law. Your husband died. You were a young widow. You could have gone on your own way. Your mother-in-law encouraged you to go on your own way, but yet you stuck with her. Not only did you stick with her, but you left your land, you uprooted your life, and you came to a brand new place. So the first thing that impresses Boaz about Rus is her chesed. So the truth is, it's not necessarily the first thing that impressed Boaz about Rus, right? The simple reading of the text is what impressed Boaz about Rus, number one, was Sertznius. That's beautiful. The simple answer is, she was beautiful. Boaz was a widower. Boaz was a widower. He sees a beautiful woman inside of his, and she catches his attention, not in an illicit way, but again, Boaz, when Boaz understands who is this girl, so the Vilna Gaon comments on this, and the Vilna Gaon says he was a widower, he was looking to get remarried, and he saw this young woman gleaning in his field. Of course, then he also sees her, but again, when he's introduced to her, he says to her, I've heard all about your chesed. I don't even know who you are, and I've never met you, but isn't it amazing that an anonymous girl from the fields of Moab who comes back is known already for her chesed? She's known for her chesed. In number three, Boaz again says this. Now I'm skipping. Number two is from the second chapter of Rus. Number three is from the third chapter. Vayomer brucha atla Hashem biti. This is Boaz says, blessed are you to Hashem, my daughter. He's talking to Rus. Heitavt chasdecha acharon min harishon. This last chesed you did is even greater than the first chesed you did. Levilti leches acharya b'acharim im dal v'im ashir. So remember again, what's the second chesed that Boaz is making reference to? What's the second chesed? Her willingness to marry Boaz. We'll talk about this in subsequent shiurim. There's a significant age difference between Boaz and Rus. Why does Rus marry Boaz? Why? So remember again, because it was a form of levirate marriage. It was a form of yibum, right? Remember again, on the technical level, the concept of yibum is if a man dies, chas v'shalom, without children, his surviving brother is obligated to marry the widow. If the brother wants, then the widow wants. Which, of course, is an incredible anomaly because under normal circumstances, this is a forbidden relationship. This is arayos, right? It's immorality. But ultimately, again, under these circumstances, the brother is commanded to marry the surviving widow. In biblical times, there was an expanded form of yibum, that even if there wasn't a surviving brother, there was a concept that the closest surviving relative would marry and take responsibility ultimately for the widow. The truth is, we know from the story of Rus, Boaz was not the closest relative. There was another closer relative, a man actually who's just known in the Megillah as how? Ploni Almoni, right? So why is it Ploni? It means John Doe. Why is he called John Doe? He's called John Doe to protect his reputation. Because at the end of the day, he missed out on marrying Rus and being the Zayda of the Davidic line. So ultimately, again, it's called Ploni Almoni. So what Boaz is referring to over here is this chesed. Rus, you're a beautiful young woman. You could have had your choice of men throughout the land. You're choosing to marry me, a much older man. And what's driving you to do this? What's driving you? What's driving you to do this is a sense of dedication and commitment to your deceased husband. It's somehow a need to perpetuate his legacy. Even though, again, I want to be clear, Rus's deceased husband was no saint. Remember, again, the Megillah does not speak kindly about Machlon and Kilion. Right? Especially if you go with the narrative that Rus and Arpa were not Jewish when Machlon and Kilion married them, which is the simple reading of the text. So ultimately, Boaz says, you're exceptional. This chesed you're doing now by marrying me, this very little, we don't think about this often, but like the Chazal tell us that according to one version of the narrative, Boaz died almost immediately after marrying Rus. They got married, she became pregnant, and he died. There was no like everyone lived happily ever after. There wasn't like Boaz and Ruth rode into the sunset and everything was fantastic. There was none of that. There was no honeymoon over here. Her entire life was a sense of commitment and a sense of duty. So he says to her, the chesed you did right now, this chesed of marrying me, of wanting to marry me, is even greater than your first chesed. So there's a whole discussion, again, I'm not going to get into it now, but there's a whole discussion, what first chesed is Boaz referring to? So it's interesting, the simple reading is, what's the first chesed he's referring to? Naomi, as we mentioned before, the fact that she did not leave her old broken mother-in-law alone, that she followed her, she went with her. In fact, the Ibn Ezra says the first chesed is a reference to the fact that she converted, that Ruth converted. That was a chesed you did for Klal Yisrael, a chesed kiviyachal that you did for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that you chose to go ahead. But either way, the point of view is you see that throughout the story of Megillah. And by the way, although we're not making explicit mentioning of this, remember, how do Boaz and Ruth meet? This is a very important part of the story. How do they meet? Right, they meet even before the silo, right? Before the silo episode, right? That's when they meet in a more intimate fashion, just the two of them. But where do they first meet? In the fields. Why? How do they? Why in the fields? Because Ruth came to collect the gleanings. Why? Because Boaz was the most notable Baal Chesed in the region. He was the most notable Baal Tzedakah. Therefore, says the Medrash, Megillas Rus, you're right, there's no halachas, there's no, what is it? It's to teach the centrality and importance of chesed. Chesed, chesed, chesed. Every single character in the story, and again, remember, that's why, unfortunately, who is considered to be the villain of the story? Who's the villain? It's really Elimelech. Isn't this amazing? Elimelech is the villain of the story. Elimelech, the husband of the husband of Naomi. Why is he the villain? Because he was the anti-chesed. Right? Remember again, the reason he left Eretz Yisrael to go to Moab was because there was a massive famine. He was very wealthy, and he did not want to deplete his wealth by having to support the hungry Jews during the years of famine. That's why he relocates. His entire life unravels his entire family. So the Megillah is almost this study in contrast. There's the story of Elimelech, who is the anti-chesed, who ultimately, again, does anything to absolve himself of having to help the other, and he dies and his life unravels. Everyone else in the story, even Arpah often gets a very bad rap. I'm here to defend Arpah, right? Why? Because Arpah, she left. Okay, Arpah left. But remember, she was willing to stay. Meaning, had Naomi said, okay, come with me, fine, you want to come, Arpah would have come also. Arpah would have come also. Arpah goes back because Naomi says, don't go back. Okay, Naomi says, go back home. Arpah was also, remember, Arpah also has her chesed. Right, Arpa also was a balas chesed. So Arpa is a balas chesed. Rus is a balas chesed. Naomi is a balas chesed. Boaz is a bal chesed. The story of Megillas Rus, says the Medrash, is a story of the power of chesed. Worlds are created. Relationships are forged. Lives are rehabilitated when we operate with a sense of chesed. And in fact, the Medrash explains this in a more global fashion. The Medrash says in general, this is not about Megillas Rus. This is just about Torah. HaTorah tchilasa chesed, sofa chesed, ve'emtsa'isa chesed. This is a very beautiful medrash. The Torah, the beginning of the Torah is focused on chesed. The middle of the Torah is focused on chesed. And the end of the Torah is focused on chesed. How so? Look how beautiful this is. Tchilasa chesed minayim. Where is there chesed in the beginning of the Torah? This is so beautiful. Atamotze kishayatzer HaKadosh Baruch Hu chava. Kishta ve'evila la'adam. Excuse me, listen to how beautiful this is. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Adam and Chava, right? So what did he do? What did he do? He braided Chava's hair before he brought her to the chuppah. The Ribbon Shalom himself braided Chava's hair. That was the first chesed. It's interesting, by the way. The chesed, you would have thought the first chesed was what? That he created us. So remember again, that's subject to a whole other dispute as to whether or not it's good that we were created or not. That's a different discussion. But once we're created, the first chesed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for mankind is that Ribbono Shel Olam braided Chava's hair, which if you think about it, by the way, is so incredibly amazing. I would say the first chesed is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Adam food to eat, right? That ultimately, again, he gave him the world. No. Isn't it amazing? Sometimes, we all know this from life, the greatest chasadim you can do for others, and sometimes the greatest chasadim that other people do for you, are not like earth-shattering, you know, life-altering chasadim. They're small little tokens. They're small little acts. It's a gesture. It's a word. It's a kind thing that someone did not need to do, but exhibit or display an incredible care and concern and empathy through doing it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not have to braid Chava's hair. I'm sure Chava was beautiful with or without the braid. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu realized Chava would feel more beautiful with the braid. And Adam would fall even in deeper love with her with the braid because she looked more beautiful. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, first act of chesed is he braids Chava's hair. What's the middle section of chesed? I'm going a little bit out of order. The middle section, the Medrash explains, is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to visit Avram Avinu after the Bris Milah. Bikur Cholim, Parshas Vayera. It's not punked in the middle of the Torah, but you understand it means in the midst of the Torah. So God does Bikur Cholim Chesed. And of course, what's the end of the Torah? Excuse me, what's the last Chesed in the Torah? Chesed Baruch Hu buries Moshe Rabbeinu. Kvuras Hames, burying the dead, which is not just Chesed, but ultimately considered to be Chesed Shel Emes, the highest form of Chesed. Therefore, says the Medrash, and there's so much to say on this, there's so much to say on this Medrash itself, because even if you look at these different acts of Chesed, each of them are very different in their own way. Kind of working backwards, Chesed Shel Emes, burying the dead, the highest form of chesed. Bikur cholim, there's mamish like something, you know, the Chazal tell us when you go to visit someone who's sick, you take away 1/60th of their choli. There's something substantive you're doing for someone. The braiding of Chava's hair, something at first glance that would feel, that looks, it's not necessary, but it was a gesture of friendship, a gesture of camaraderie, a gesture of concern, a gesture of love, all different types of chesed. So therefore, again, using this medrash and the Yakut Shmoni number one, this is the message of Megillas Rus. To once, again, the Torah itself, beginning, middle, and end, highlights the centrality and importance of chesed. And so the Megillah is a book which in and of itself also focuses, highlights, and reinforces this importance of chesed. But we have to ask ourselves a simple question, which is, we have plenty of chesed stories, right? There are no shortage of chesed stories. Just look at Sefer Bereishis. It's all chesed stories. Rivka Imenu, chesed stories. All chesed stories. Rachel Imenu, chesed stories. Rivka, chesed stories. Leah, chesed stories. Plenty of chesed stories. So obviously, I don't just need another book of chesed stories. It must be that the Megillah is giving me something additional. There must be something than just an emphasis on chesed. There must be another lesson layered on top of this. So what is it? So I'll show you something amazing. If you look at the end of Megillas Rus, so remember again, how does the Megillah end? Megillah ends in a very dramatic way. Ve'ela toldos, so remember again, so Rus gives birth. Ve'ela toldos peretz, peretz holy des chetzron, chetzron holy des ram, ram holy des Aminadav, Aminadav holy des Nachshon, Nachshon holy des Salma, Salmon holy des Boaz, right? Rus's husband. Uboaz holy des Oved. So Oved is the son that Rus and Boaz have together. The Oved holy des Yishai. Oved gives birth to Yishai. The Yishai holy des David. And Yishai gives birth to David. So Rus and Boaz are the great grandparents. The great grandparents of David HaMelech. And this is how Megillas Rus ends. This is how Megillas Rus ends, which is actually very interesting because in general there's a discussion. So remember, why do we have Megillas Rus? The fact that Megillas Rus ends like this tells us that what? Really the entire essence of Megillas Rus is not the story about Rus. It's to give us the pre-story, right? The introduction, the prologue to David HaMelech. All of this, the entire Megillas Rus is an introduction to David HaMelech. Actually, as an aside, we'll get into this in just a moment, There are many who explain that the whole reason Megillas Rus was codified was because it is supposed to represent the family tree of King David. David HaMelech's greatest detractors wanted to say that he's not fit to be king because he doesn't have the right lineage. The beauty of Megillas Rus, is that it shows David HaMelech's lineage quite explicitly. David HaMelech hails from the tribe of Yehuda, from the nobility of Yehuda, and as such, that gives him the right to the throne. But I'll tell you something amazing. So Megillas Rus, therefore, is the story of the beginning of our monarchy. Although David HaMelech is the first king in a dynastic monarchy, the story of the monarchy does not start with David. The story of the monarchy begins with the Alter Baba. It begins with his great-grandmother and his great-grandfather, with Rus and with Boaz, to teach us something incredibly amazing. What is the role of a king? What is the job of the king? What's the job description of the melech? So the truth is, the Navi in Yeshayahu says in number 7, the Navi says it quite explicitly. Look, it's verse number 7. V'hu chan b'chesed kisei. Very simply, the Navi says, and the throne shall be established through loving kindness, through chesed. And writes the Ibn Ezra, ultimately, again, what is the king supposed to do with his power? What does the king do with his privilege? What does the king do with his influence? It is the king's job to be a Baal Chesed. That is the king's job. He has many other responsibilities as well. Many other responsibilities. He has to run a country, he has to run an economy, he has to oversee the army, he has to oversee religious standards. But at the end of the day, his major mandate is do as much chesed for your people as you can. Remember again, go back to the Navi. What does David HaMelech do when he first becomes king? When he first becomes king, he listens to all of the disputes. He becomes like a Beis Din. People come to him with their problems, right? I had a machlokes with Reuven, with Shimon, with this, that, the sheep, the goat, the this. And David HaMelech, the king of Israel, the father of the messianic line, first dynastic ruler, is listening to all of their squabbles. You know, why? Because it's his job to help people out. That's the job of a king. So this entire story, which ultimately goes ahead and this entire story lays the groundwork for the monarchy. This is the story of the genesis of the monarchy of the Jewish people. This is the story of the genesis of Mashiach. What is the job of the king? What is the job of Mashiach? And the answer is to do chesed. To be a Baal Chesed. You know, there's an amazing Gemara. I didn't put on this sheet. I don't know why. I apologize. The Gemara discusses, where is the Mashiach? Right? Where is the Mashiach? Actually, I will come back to that Gemara at a different time, because it takes off a little bit of attention. But you remind me about Mashiach Gemara, probably not this year, but next year. So in any event, according to this approach, the Megillah is not just teaching me another book about Chesed. Right? That I have a Chumash for. The Megillah is the story of the beginning of the monarchy. And lest you wonder to yourself, what is the job of a Jewish king? What is the job of a Jewish leader? And the answer is, be a Baal Chesed for the Klal. That is your job. Be a Baal Chesed for the Klal. And understand the profundity in this. Is there anyone busier than the king? Right? Is there anyone busier than the king? No. So if it's the king's job to be a Baal Chesed, then imagine what our responsibilities are as well. You know, I found this very striking, because if you think about it a little bit, how much better the world would be if leaders in general took this approach to leadership. You know, it's an amazing thing to see, and it's very sobering. I don't know if as I'm getting older, maybe, but or just things strike me in different ways, but it's very saddening to see how so often those who occupy positions of public leadership, it has nothing to do with serving their constituency and nothing to do with using an office or using power to help. It's often just about preserving that power, right? This is not a political statement. This is the nature of the world. This is what the people, political leaders who are not like this are an exception to the rule. But in general, you see it with all the political jockeying and the manipulating and the deal making, and all of this is to preserve power, is to preserve authority, is to preserve entitlement. instead of thinking about, I have this position, if I get reelected, don't get reelected, here's where I am now, what can I do to help? That's what happens with leaders, right? Even the best of leaders, the power goes to their heads, right? Who was the greatest? One of the greatest examples of this was Yeravam ben Nevat. We know that under Shlomo HaMelech, the Malchus, the monarchy, splits into two. And what happens? So God sends the Navi to go ahead and tell Yeravam ben Nevat, you are going to be the king over the new Malchus, over the split-off kingdom. And Yeravam ben Nevat says, no, I don't want to do it. Shlomo's the king. He's part of the Davidic line. I don't want to be king. And so the Navi says, well, God wants you to be king, you be king. So Yeravam ben Nevat begrudgingly says, fine, but he's a good firm guy. What happens? Just a couple of prakim later, what's the first order of business that Yeravam ben Nevat does? The calves. He erects golden calves at the border between his kingdom and Malchus Yehuda. Why? Because he doesn't want Jews going to the Beis HaMikdash. Because if they go to the Beis HaMikdash, which is in the tribal portion of Yehuda, it's only a matter of time until their allegiances leave him and go back to the Davidic king. Isn't that amazing? A parak ago, right? A chapter ago, you didn't want the monarchy. A chapter ago, you were trying to convince the prophet, let's go all back under Shlomo HaMelech, preserve the Davidic line. And a chapter or two later, you're erecting golden calves in order to preserve your power. That's what happens. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu realized this. And so what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? He gives David HaMelech the story of his family's history. And the story of his family's history is Chesed. David, you're here. You're here in this world because of Chesed. Without chesed, you would have never been born. Without chesed, there would have never been a messianic line. Why do you come into this world like this? To teach you that what's your mandate? What's your job? What's your responsibility? It's to be about chesed. That is hands down your job. And ultimately for us, if that's the job of the melech to be about chesed, then of course it becomes our job to be Baalei Chesed as well. So that's lesson number one that comes out from Megillah Esros, and that's the meaning of the Medrash. Now, so what does Megillah Esros teach us? First of all, it's not Metamei Adam, it doesn't convey Tumah, so it doesn't seem to be like Kisvei HaKodesh. Doesn't have Halochas, Isser and Heter, Mutter, Aser, Kasher, Treif. So what does it teach us? The power of Chesed, wonderful! I learned the power of Chesed from Bereishis, Avram and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, I learned Chesed. No, this is different. Because this is the story of the genesis of the monarchy. And this is to remind us that the job of Jewish monarchy, the job of Jewish leadership, and the job of the rest of us who are not vested with that same level of authority, is to see what we can do to benefit the other, to see what we can do to benefit the klal, to see what we can do to make this world a little bit of a better place. It is our job and our sacred mission and task to become Baalei Chesed. But there's one additional lesson from Megillah Esros. On a different direction. Take a look at number 11. So this is another striking aspect of the Megillah. Vayisulam, going back to the beginning of the Megillah, remember again, Elimelech and his wife, Naomi, and his sons, Machlon and Kilion, leave Eretz Yisrael, and they settle in the fields of Moab. So what does the Megillah tell us? Vayisulam nashim Moabios, they married Moabite girls, Shem ha'achas Arpa, v'shem ha'shenis Rus. One was named Arpa, one was named Rus. Vayishu sham kaser sham. They lived in Moab for 10 years, a decade in Moab. Okay, so here the Navi clearly identifies them as Moabite girls. It makes sense. Machlon and Kilion, according to the basic pshat, the simple understanding of the verses, intermarried. Intermarried. There's a whole fascinating discussion as to when exactly Rus converted. Right? Did she convert for marriage? Did she convert when she told Naomi, I'm going with you? Did she convert when she came back to Eretz Yisrael? We know she converted. Machlokes exactly when. But there's no question. Well, I should say there's no question. It would appear, based on the simple reading of the text, that Machlon and Kilion intermarried, and therefore the Megillah goes out of its way to tell us they married Moabite girls. But look what's interesting. Look at number 12. At the end of chapter 1, so remember again, at this point in time, almost according to everyone, Rus is Jewish. She's converted. Either she converted for marriage, or she converted again with Naomi. But yet, how does the Megillah refer to? V'atashav Naomi v'Rus ha-Moavia kalaseima. Once again, she is referred to as Rus ha-Moavia, the Moabite. It goes on. Look at number 13. This is the fourth chapter, the last chapter in Megillas Rus. To give you the context, this is where Boaz is speaking to the elders and telling them his intention to marry Rus. Vayomer Boaz Lezakenim, number 13, V'chala'am. Eidim atam ayom, you are my witnesses today. Ki kanisi es kol asher le'ali melech, v'es kol asher le'kilyon al-machlon miyad na'ami. I have acquired, I'm hereby taking the place of Machlon, Kilyon, and Eli Melech. V'gam es Rus ha-Moavia, eish es Machlon kanisi li le'isha. And I'm going to marry Rus ha-Moavia. She's going to be my wife. La'hakim shim ha-meis ha-nachalasa v'lo'ikais, in order to go ahead and perpetuate the legacy of her now deceased husband. Why is this amazing? Again, what are we calling her? Rus ha-Moavia. Rus ha-Moavia. Do you know that there is a major no-no when it comes to converts? And what's the major no-no? Hi, shalom aleichem, Sarah, who used to eat cheeseburgers, right? Oh, nice to meet you. Reuven used to celebrate Christmas. Very wonderful to have you with us. You don't do that, right? You don't do it to a Baal Tshuva, right? You don't do, wow, you must really miss shellfish a lot, right? We don't do that. You don't talk that way to Baal Tshuva. You don't talk that way to Geirim. And yet, amazingly enough, what's happening over here, every single time, this, you know, I want to point something out. It's not like there are two women named Rus in the Megillah. So, oh, which one are you talking about? The regular Rus or Rus HaMoavia? There's one Rus. There's one Rus. We know where she's from. We know her beginnings. And she converted. By now, certainly again, even if you want to say she's not Jewish in number one, okay, Moavia. Even if you want to say she's not Jewish in number two, when they come back, okay, Moavia. By Perek Dalid in number 13, she's about to marry Boaz, the Gadol Hadar. She's Jewish. She's Jewish. Yet we are still calling her HaMoavia, still constantly referring to her as the Moabite. So first of all, besides the fact that general standard convert practice, it seems to be wrong. We generally don't do this to converts. In fact, you're showing this when it comes to the converts, there's a general mitzvah to love another Jew as you love yourself. And by a convert, there's an additional mitzvah of via hafta mesager. So you have to love a convert doubly as much. Number one, because he or she is a fellow Jew. Number two, because they have a specific mitzvah, there is to love the convert. Incredible. And yet here, I'm calling Rus over and over and over, Rus HaMoavia, the Moabite. So I want to show you something amazing. The Torah speaks about the Moabites. What does the Torah say? Lo yavo amoni u'moavi bekal Hashem. We are not permitted to accept converts from the nations of Ammon and Moab, Gam Dora Siri, even 10 generations down. They are not permitted to convert. They're not permitted to marry into the Jewish people. Why? Al Divar Asher Lo Kidmu Eschem Balechem Ubamayim Bederech Betzeischem Mitzrayim. Because when you came out of Egypt, they did not greet you with bread and water. And they also tried to hire Bilam ben Ba'ar to curse us and to destroy us. So amazingly enough, we don't proselytize, but we open our arms to Geirim. Not only that, by the way, I'll tell you something even more amazing. If somebody from Amalek wants to go ahead and convert, what's the halacha? You accept them, right? If a person is a true Baal Tshuva, person accept them, an Amalekite, I could accept. Ammon and Moab will focus more of you on Moab. Can't accept the Moabite convert. Which, by the way, this you should know, one of the greatest reasons that David HaMelech had detractors is because people wanted to suggest that his great-grandmother wasn't Jewish, when in fact this halacha only applies to the male members of Ammon and Moab, not to the women. But that's an aside. So why? Because Moab didn't greet us with bread and water. We came out of Egypt. Ammon and Moab they're our cousins. Remember again, Ammon and Moab are the descendants of Lot. We are the descendants of Avram Avinu. They are our cousins. And yet when we came out of Egypt, a newly minted nation, they did not greet us with bread and water. Not only did not greet us with bread and water, but they hired a prophet to curse us. Now what's interesting over here is you would think, which is the worst transgression? Hiring the prophet, right? I would think again, Bilam, right? Bilam wanted to destroy us. It's okay, thank you. I don't need the bread and water. Just don't kill, you know, don't do me, don't do anything nice. Also, don't try to kill me. But yet the Torah puts the lack of civility, the lack of bringing us bread and water as the first transgression. Right to the Medrash, number 15. What's so bad about that? Lo zachra tova sha'asa Avram lelot. She'il mole Avram lom nimlat lot mistom. V'ne'emar v'hi b'shachis akimis arya kikar. So remember, again, let's go back for a moment. Ammon and Moab come from Lot, but they also come from a pretty sordid story. Remember again, Ammon and Moab come from Lot's incestuous relationship with his two daughters. With his two daughters, two consecutive nights of incest, one with each of his daughters. That produces Ammon and Moab. That only happened, why? Because Lot was saved from stone. Why was Lot saved from stone? Not in his own merit, but in the merit of Avraham Avinu. And therefore again, says the Medrash, the fact that Ammon and Moab didn't greet us with bread and water when we came out was a fundamental lack of gratitude. You guys only exist because of us. Our Zayda saved your Zayda. Without the merit of Avraham Avinu, you guys would have never existed. On a basic gratitude level, when someone does something nice for you, reciprocate. Avram did many nice things for Lot. Now Avram's children are quote-unquote in need. Lot's children should respond in kind. But they didn't. And because they lacked this basic attribute of gratitude, remember again, like this Sfarno points out, Jews are colloquially known as Yehudim. Why are we known as Yehudim? So it's on the most basic level, it's because after the exile of the 10 tribes, most of the Jews who were left were from the Shevet of Yehuda. So we're Yehudim. But the Sfarno says something amazing. He says, we're called Yehudim because what's the name Yehuda? Hodah. Gratitude. Leia Imenu says, Hapam Odes Hashem. This time I will thank God. What is the most important attribute for a Jew to possess? The ability to say thank you. The ability to have gratitude. So Ammon and Moab, you don't even have basic gratitude. Our grandfather saved your grandfather. Now, yeah, we don't need you to save us, but now you have an opportunity to reciprocate. You don't do it? No, thank you. We don't want you as part of Klal Yisrael. But if you look at number 16, the Rabbeinu Bachai says something different. He says, Al divar asher lo kidmu eschem balechem v'mayim derech eretzu lekadim es haboim b'derech b'ma'achal u'b'mishta. It is derech eretz. This is not gratitude. This is not reciprocity. What is this? Derech Eretz. Menschlichkeit. Simple, normative behavior. A stranger comes, right there in the middle of the desert, you offer them food and drink. Now look what the Rabbeinu Bachai says. Lo shehayu Yisrael chaserim b'midbar. Let's be clear. Did we need the food and drink of Ammon and Moab?
No.
No, why not? Shehari Haman yored lohem v'habe'er. Right? Isn't this amazing? We had the man, right? We had a well. We had what we needed. We had what we needed. So we did not need them to come to us with food and drink. But it's menschlichkeit. It's basic, proper interpersonal conduct. A stranger comes, they're traveling in the desert, 3.5 million people there. You don't know they have man. You don't know they have a well. We don't need any of your kindness. But the fact that you did not go ahead and come out and offer us something was a fundamental lack of humanity. See, according to the Medrash, it was a lack of gratitude. The Rabbeinu Bachai says, no. This is much more severe and significant than a lack of gratitude. This is a fundamental lack of humanity. You're not normal people. Normal people are nice. Normal people are kind. Normal people see a stranger in the desert, and of course you offer food and water. And if you can't do that, there's not something missing in your gratitude. There's something missing in your humanity. But not to defend the actions of Ammon and Moab, but just to explain something, it was part of their makeup. Because remember again, let's go back in history a little bit. Number 17, the Pasuk says, when Lot and his family are escaping from Sodom, so what happens? What does the Pasuk say? Vatabet ishto me'acharav vatihi nitziv melach. Mrs. Lot, Medrash identifies her name as Iris. Iris looks back. Malach said, don't look back. She looks back. What does she become? She becomes a pillar of salt. Why salt, says Rashi, number 18. V'melach chata u'b'melach loksa. She sinned with salt, and therefore she's punished with salt. Why did she sin with salt? Amr la, when Lot brings home the guests, he says to his wife, you're serving them matzah or bread, whatever they were eating, give them a little bit of salt with the bread. Amr lo, She gives him mussar. It's bad enough you brought home company. Now you want to go ahead and give them salt also? So she sinned with salt, and therefore she's punished with salt. Why is this incredibly amazing? Because understand, Ammon and Moab come from Lot, right? Ammon and Moab come from Lot and his daughters. His daughters come from Lot and his wife. This lack of humanity, this lack of a willingness to share, this lacking of an understanding of giving of yourself, of chesed, it was part of their genetic DNA. It was part of their DNA. It was part of their makeup. This didn't start with Ammon and Moab. This went back to Lot. This went back to Iris. This is what these girls saw in their home. They saw, you know, every parent knows that even when you try to conceal that you're arguing with your spouse in front of the kids always know that you're arguing, and not only that, they usually even know what you're arguing about. An incredible, incredible thing. So you don't think the kids saw this argument between Lot and Iris? Of course they did. And they were already adult women. Of course they did. So they saw from their mother. They saw from their mother. What silliness. Get your own salt. It's bad enough you're eating my bread. It's bad enough you're sleeping in my house. It's bad enough you're drinking my water. I'm not giving you anything else. Get out of here. Remember again, that was Stone. Stone must take care of yourself. Self-sufficiency. No dependency. Every man for himself. Every woman for herself. So therefore again, this was in their DNA. Salot was like this. Iris was like this. The girls were like this. And by extension, we see it passed down generation after generation after generation. It was a dominant spiritual gene in the descendants of Lot. Not just a lack of gratitude, but a fundamental lack of humanity. An inability to have empathy. An inability to have sympathy. An inability to give to the other. This is who they were. But I'll show you something amazing. Take a look at number 19. There's a beautiful pasuk in Tehillim. Matsasi David Avdi B'shemen Kadshi Meshachtiv. The pasuk says, I found my servant David. I anointed him with my holy oil. So the Medrash writes something amazing. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, number 20, the final source. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Matsasi David Avdi. I found David my servant. Heichin Matsasi Oso. Where did I find David? Where was David hiding? B'Sdom. If you want to find David HaMelech, you'll find him in Sdom. What does that mean? Because if you trace David HaMelech's family tree all the way back, where does it all begin? It all begins in Sdom. It all begins in Sdom. It all begins with Lot and Iris and the girls and the two episodes in the cave and a whole Mammon and Moab, and Rus and David. Matsasi David Avdi. I found David my servant. And where did I find him? I found him in Stone. What's the power of this story? I think that perhaps the power of Megillas Rus is the power of personalistic change. You see, we all are born with predispositions. We are born with certain proclivities. We are all born with certain character traits. That is true, meaning as much as we like to say, you're born a tabula rasa, that's not true. It's not true. We're not born a tabula rasa. You're not born a blank slate. Right? Just like my eye color is determined by genetics, my hair, or lack of hair, right, is determined by genetics, right? My height, so many things are determined by genetics. Your mitos are also determined by genetics. There's no question. There are some people who just have a shorter fuse, a temper, and you could see it's part of their temperament. Just like the Gemara says, if somebody is born with red hair, right? Somebody's a gingy, right? Somebody is a domi. So what does that mean? They're going to shed blood, right? Which the Gemara says doesn't mean you have to be a murderer, right? You could be a moel, you could be a surgeon, but what it really means is that's a passionate person. All of our redheads throughout the Torah, David HaMelech, Esav, were all vibrant, vigorous, passionate people. It was just the shaila as to how you tried to channel it. But Chazal never talked about a calm redhead, right? They never talked about, again, a redhead who's just, you know, just quiet and went about their business. What does that mean? It means that there are certain genetic predispositions we have. So Ammon and Moab, focusing more on Moab right now, Moab had a genetic predisposition. What type of genetic predisposition? For what? For what? For selfishness. For myopic worldview. Life is about me. My resources are for me. My co-hosts are for me. You take care of you. I'll take care of me. That was the genetic predisposition. I would even venture to say that the people of Moab, when they saw the Jews coming out of Egypt and were in the desert, I don't even think that they had a conversation. Should we go out and greet them with bread and water? Should it be bread, milchiks, fleishiks, lakishka? What should we bring them? I don't even think the conversation ever started. I don't even think it was even a cognitive process. At the end of the day, it just wasn't part of their vernacular. It wasn't part of their thought process because it wasn't part of their DNA. They didn't make an active decision to slight Klal. I don't think. They made an active decision to slight Klal Yisrael. They just were simply uninterested. They were just simply uninterested. So herein lies the power of Megillas Rus. Rus was a Moaviah. Rus was a Moavis. But she made a decision to defy, to change, to modify her spiritual and genetic predisposition. I know who I come from. I know who my parents are, my grandparents are. I could trace my lineage all the way back up to Lot, to his wife, to the daughters. Remember, now you have to remember again, Rus was Moabite nobility. She wasn't just a Moabite. She was Moabite nobility. And the entire story of Megillas Rus is not simply a story of chesed. It's a story of profound, cathartic, overwhelming, personalistic change. A person who has genetic markers for selfishness, for self-absorbedness, for egocentricity, but makes a decision to be different. Makes a decision to defy all of that, all of the genetics, and make herself into something different. Even though she was from this nation, and even though she had this upbringing, she chose to become a different kind of person. How did she choose to become a different kind of person? Her choice was manifest through chesed. She chose a lifestyle that was the polar opposite of the lifestyle she had been brought up with. She chose ideals that were fundamentally opposed to the ideas of her childhood, to the ideas of her family, to the ideals of her nation. So what's the message? The message is that no matter what your predispositions may be, no matter what your proclivities may be, no matter what the genetic markers you were born with, you choose the kind of person you want to become. You choose the you want to be. You choose the identity that you possess. We like to hide behind a lot of different things, right? And we like to make a ton of different excuses for why we don't self-actualize and become the people I know, the person I know I can be and I should be. And we love to blame biology. And we love to blame genetics. And we love to blame upbringing. And we love to blame parents. And we love to blame culture and community. And I want to be clear, all of those things absolutely have an impact on who we become. But at the end of the day, you become the person you choose to become. And if you don't become the person you know you can be, it's not because of your genetics. And it's not because of your parents. And it's not because of your nation or your community. It's because you're choosing not to become that person. You'll say, that's crazy? That's the story of Megillas Rus. So if we bring this all together, it turns out that Megillas Rus really teaches us these two incredibly profound lessons. Number one, the power of chesed. But the power of chesed we already know from Torah, right? The power of chesed we already know from Bereishis. That's the entire essence of the book of Bereishis, the power of chesed. But it's a different kind of chesed. It's the chesed as the blueprint, as the underpinning for the monarchy. Jewish leadership is all about affecting positive change in your constituents, in your community, in your people. Jewish leadership is all about taking the responsibilities and the kochos you have and making change, positive change. And if that's true for the melech, who is saddled with so much responsibility, then Megillas Rus teaches us that that is our responsibility as well. Lesson number two, Rus is not just any Ba'alas Chesed. Rus is the Ba'alas Chesed who chose to defy her genetics and become someone and something different, which teaches us this most incredible lesson. A lot of us definitely have things that work against us. Whether it's genetics, whether it's upbringing, whether it's life factors, relationship factors, there's a ton of things. There's sometimes, you know, I know where I want to get, but sometimes I always feel like I'm swimming against the current. And a lot of times I am swimming against the current. And that current could be strong. And that current is negative, filled with all different things in life. But at the end of the day, what Rose teaches us is you can become the person you want to become if you choose to become that person. Power of choice is indescribable. If you want to become a certain person, if you want to self-actualize in a certain way, it is true you may have to overcome your life circumstances. You may have to overcome certain flawed aspects of your upbringing. You may have to overcome certain negativity within your community. And you may even have to change your very genetic and spiritual makeup. But Rus teaches us that it can be done. And if Rus, a simple Moabite girl, right, a simple Moabite girl, could change herself in such a dramatic way, could choose to go from a nation of selfish egocentricity, cultural selfishness and egocentricity, to go and to lead a life of dramatic selflessness, transform herself into the mother of not just the Davidic kingdom, but the messianic line. If she has that koach, then we have that koach as well. All right, we'll stop over here.